on Sunday.
Yes, we are back on Sunday, back on track. And you know what it is. You know what it is. We're coming back at you with a top 10. You know, last time we had our little experimental sesh. And this week, we're going back to a bit more of a, like, I guess, concrete format, which is our top 10. And this is a pretty nice top 10, the one that I've actually been wanting to do for a very long time. I feel like I say that every time, but you know what? Top 10s are fun. I mean, not that all the other stuff isn't fun, but we're doing. Ben, you wanna go ahead and introduce the top 10?
All right, top 10 transformations.
Yes, so top 10 transformations in any manga. And at least for me, I'm assuming this also goes for your list, Ben, but who knows? Transformations are obviously a pretty kind of, you know, subjective category of power-up or whatever, but that's what it could be, right? It could be a power-up, like that's significant enough to change appearance or just abilities, or it could be a combination of that and like a character-based kind of transformation, which it often does, kind of like those two often link, like a power-based and a character-based transformation, like in personality. So it's a lot of different stuff. So if maybe something does not appear to you as like a power-up, I mean, you know, that's just how it'd be. That's just how it'd be. Sorry. But we're going to get going right soon, ain't we? All right, then, Ben, would you like to start us up with your number 10 spot?
All right. So number 10 on my list is Golden Experience Requiem, which is Giorno's stand's transformation in JoJo Part 5, Golden Wind. So this is actually probably the most overpowered one on my list, surprisingly. But Giorno achieves this transformation, Giorno being the protagonist, by gaining the stand arrow and stabbing it into his stand, or his as they're known, JoJo. And he Giorno's stand, Golden Experience, evolves into Gold Experience Requiem, which has the power to put people in an infinite death loop.
Yes, among other weird things. Basically, there's a whole debate, and I'm not going to go geeking out on all the non-JoJo. No, never mind. but essentially, GR has the ability of zero. How cool does that sound? But it's true, because it basically just neutralizes anything that, you know, has a cause back to its effect, which is pretty cool, because then, like, someone can punch you, and then you can punch them back, and it would be like they never punched you at all, you know? Stuff like that. It's complicated. Yeah. Complicated. Yeah. Huh? I feel like I have a lot of energy today. All right. So GR, sorry I interrupted, but was there like another thing you were going to comment on the first pick that you made?
Yeah. I mean, I think I said, I pretty much said what I wanted to say, but it is a very cool transformation, yeah.
Well, it is cool in the sense that, like, you know, Gold Experience, I feel, looked very meek, and I guess just a bit impersonal, especially considering the few stands we had had before that of the main JoJo, including Star Platinum and Crazy Diamond, right? Like, both of those stands were, like, sort of stands you could almost see as, like, these, like, you could see they were a bit independent. They were different from who their masters were. They were sort of like another essence in and of themselves, whereas Gold Experience was just sort of like, just, hey, I look like an Egyptian statue.
pretty much.
And then Gold Experience Requiem is sort of just like, you know, a bit, it looks cooler and it looks a bit more like, well, like a more kind of powerful, almost sentient stand, I feel.
Yeah. Well, which it is, because Golden Experience Requiem acts almost independently of Giorno as well, right?
I mean, true, it is, because I mean, it's true. Yes. So I'll go ahead with my number one, my number 10 pick. We're going in that order, which is actually a pretty, I think, less well-known transformation that happened, I think, also relatively recently in a pretty niche manga, but that I really enjoyed. So Gleipnir is actually a manga that I read recently. It's a really weird story. I mean, it's really weird in terms of like the aesthetic and the general tone, but the actual plot is pretty solid. in terms of like, it's not too zany. I'm not saying that zany plots aren't solid, but you know what I mean. But it's essentially the protagonist has the ability originally to activate a transformation that makes him into a big kind of scary bear fursuit that can shoot bullets. That's his ability. And you know, he has enhanced speed. Yeah, all of the above, enhanced strength. But he's, you know, he looks like a demented Friday Nights at Freddy's automaton, you know, like that's basically his ability. But as the series goes on, he is attempting, you know, to kind of, as you would expect from a story that has to do with supernatural powers in the modern age, and he's trying to navigate this world where, you know, people are using those powers pretty, like in a pretty negative way to cause a lot of harm to people, or they're just doing it in a way that is very selfish and kind of negligent, or they're trying to achieve something that benefits them at the expense of a lot of other people. And eventually, as the stakes get higher and higher, and the abilities of the people that they're fighting against have become very, very kind of, intense. Like they're really kind of like the aura of the enemies is like intimidating as heck. And they have basically no hope. They do get hope, as you would expect, because it's any manga and it's just stories in general. And that is, of course, a very common function of transformations, a kind of deus ex machina that is a bit more of a deus ex machina because it's not that cheap. It actually kind of is cool. But essentially, at the climax of the latest arc of the story, I think it's still ongoing, Shuichi, the protagonist, who has been very kind of closely guided by his friend Claire, who actually started kind of hanging out with him because she was blackmailing him because her sister was also a person with abilities and she somehow wanted some intel on her through him. And, you know, after this kind of pretty full of animosity relationship kind of goes on for a while, they forge a really incredible bond and they're able to fuse. Claire also discovers that she has the ability that allows her to fuse with Shuichi. And eventually that results in a very powerful form of Shuichi's kind of fursuit stand, but it's, you can see like, it's weird. You know, and but then like they become like this kind of ninja person, and yeah, it looks really cool, I have to say. And I especially think that it's cool that they didn't make Shuichi sort of like the inspiration for the appearance of it. Again, a lot of these transformations I'm ranking where they are a large part because of appearance and also a large part because of plot, but just keep in mind the appearance piece, which is why I love this number 10 pick. Claire and Shuichi's fruit fusion is just, I mean, I remember seeing it and I'm being like, wow. So they didn't use Shuichi as the model for the appearance, but Claire. And I just thought it was a really beautiful representation of their relationship in the sense that Shuichi just sort of bends himself to Claire's will, but at the same time, he's able to achieve his, which is to protect her, et cetera, et cetera. I think it was just a really nice symbolic. And also, of course, it let them win the fight, which was cool.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the deus ex machina part, because I feel like that also very much applies to Golden Experience Requiem. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, Giorno is just able to get the stand or like Requiem Hero and then stab it into GR. But regardless, it's GR cool. Is still, very cool.
It's
yeah,
so cool. But that's sort of the beauty of transformations to me, to a large extent, is that it is sort of a deus ex machina, but it's not like, yeah. I mean, at least in most instances, I'm sure there are some instances, but any manga, like one of the trademarks of anime and manga is transformations. I can say that without a doubt, like SSJ and everything. You know, eventually that's sort of become like a staple. And I feel like when transformations are pulled out these days, it can seem cheap, but it's part of the planning. It's not just some kind of cheap escape that the author used, mostly. So yeah, that's my excuse for liking transformations.
Yes, indeed. All right. Okay, so my number 9 is Gon's adult form from Hunter x Hunter. So this is a very interesting transformation because I mean it's very unique in nature because you would think that like, you know, I guess you wouldn't typically think of like growing up as a transformation, but, like, you know, Gon of course
is growing up in a matter of 5 seconds. That's
exactly. Gon is able to do it rapidly given that he is able to create a Nen contract, Nen being the main power source in Hunter x Hunter, and he's able to gain this, like, insane amount of power by, you know, by growing up to like be what he would be in like, say, I don't know, like 10 or 20 years if he just trained nonstop at, you know, of course, at the expense of him, you know, potentially not being able to use Nen after that and, you know, even losing his life. So,
And he's able to teach one of those too. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, because I mean, I feel like, you know, like visually, I wouldn't say it's, you know, this transformation is that, I guess, visually impressive, like compared to like, you know, some of the other ones on this list. But I feel like, I mean, this one just really deserves a lot of credit for like its sheer, I guess, you know, importance to like, you know, Gon's development as a character at that point.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, I'm gonna, this transformation does show up later on the list, but I'll expand on this in my kind of discussion of this particular transformation. But I think what is so impactful about this, especially in the anime's execution, is just this sense of impending doom. Like, it's almost like you don't want this transformation to happen. It is not a deus ex machina, actually. It is more like, you know, something even worse than maybe what could have happened if, you know, someone had saved them or something like that. Like, Gon taking this burden upon his shoulders is just like terrifying. And we're more scared of Gon in that moment than I would even say Pito, or at least I was. You know, that's a brutal transformation. I'll talk about it later.
Yeah.
All right. Next is my number 9, which is the devil's backbone form of Juzo Inui from No Gun's Life. I feel like every time I talk about the series, I kind of like try to make an effort to tell people, like, you've probably never heard of this manga, or you've probably heard very little about it, but it's really good. And it is, I'm going to say it again, it is very, very good. And one of the most important aspects of this manga, and what makes it so such an enjoyable experience for me, at least, is the aesthetic of it. It really does cyberpunk amazingly. It's about like a post-war world where people have had cybernetic implants that both enhance their physical abilities or their attack power, or just, you know, allow them to do things better at work, like computers in their brains or whatever. And Juzo Inui is actually someone who was used in the war being the factor that pushed the development of these cybernetic implantments. And his cybernetic implantment or implants are so comprehensive and so dangerous that they're sort of like not legal these days. They were really just to make super weapons, and the devil's backbone is sort of like the key to that, in the sense that, sorry, I think we're having a bit of internet turbulence here, but you know, I'll just keep going. And then, so the devil's backbone basically is the core of the Gunslave Unit, which is the name of the implant that he's had. And the Gunslave Unit allows him to basically like just have like, imagine like an infinite closet in his back. That's what the devil's backbone is. The devil's backbone just folds out and gives him like these guns that just like they would never fit in his back. And it's just like this weird absurdity that makes the transformation really interesting too, in my opinion, because eventually, like, you know, he's just there. He's like 10 times the size that he was before. And he's just tackling all of these opponents. And again, I think this is one of those transformations that for me is more visually appealing than plot-based. There is a lot of plot-based stuff that makes it cool too, if you ask me. For example, the fact that Juzo actually has to trade his devil's backbone, so that core, for a former comrade's of his. And, you know, the past that he has with his former comrade is like highlighted through that exchange, which I think is really nice too. But just in and of itself, I think the devil's backbone looks fantastic. And it also is just, you know, a cool way to really accentuate that cyberpunk tone of the series. Yeah.
So I mean, I think you were freezing up for a bit there, but hopefully it's better. Yeah. All right. So
even though you will one day, Ben, I'm sure you you haven't read No Gun's Life, so I guess, you know, yeah, but it's a definitely a good series. I would recommend it. Just saying, it probably wasn't like the end of the world that you didn't hear all of that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean, I heard most of it. I just like So anyway, all right. So at number 8 on my list is Super Saiyan 2 or SSJ 2 from Dragon Ball Z. So I feel like SSJ 2 as a transformation, really in my opinion, perfectly Super Saiyan form. It's like It's not like actually a huge like disparity, but I feel like those little like those minor differences in between those two transformations really, I guess, make it for me. I guess with Super Saiyan 2, visually, you know, with the first transformation, the hair is sort of spiked up and like, you know,
blonde.
And the golden aura, and with Super Saiyan 2, the hair is even more spiked up with you know, certain differences in like bangs and whatnot, and they also gain an electric aura, which is really cool in my opinion. And I feel like Super Saiyan 2 is actually it's actually pretty well foreshadowed, I feel like. So like in the Cell Saga, which is where it first shows up, Goku, the protagonist, obviously, is talking about how he is training to sort of surpass the Super Saiyan form, and he discovers that, like, you know, he's able to like bulk up and essentially go like Super Saiyan grade 2, not to be confused with the actual Super Saiyan 2, but like by bulking up, you know, by putting like all these extra muscles on, you just whatever you know strength you gain, you lose speed. But like Super Saiyan 2 obviously solves all that because it's of course a boost in strength and speed. But I feel like, yeah, it's a really cool form, and I feel like its presentation is very cool, even though it's not like a huge, I guess, disparity in like appearance between the first Super Saiyan form. But yeah.
And I feel like I remember you literally like showing me the two differences, because I was still a complete noob, and I still am, I guess, to Dragon Ball. And you were like pointing out like the bangs are up in Super Saiyan 2, whereas not, and like, you know, all that kind of the minor details like you're talking about. I do think that's quite cool, because even if it's minor details, subconsciously you get the message. This is even more powerful than the first form, which is cool. It's even my final form.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
Dragon Ball. Dragon. All right, so I'll move on to my number 8. Yes, which is Zod's full apostle form. Yes. So I actually like was kind of on the verge of not putting this on there, because Zod really isn't much of a significant like visual image in case he's in his full apostle form. Like, who thinks of Zod in his kind of like weird kind of goblin non-transformed form, as opposed to his actual kind of big bull horse bat thing, you know? So essentially what I'm trying to say is that Zod is sort of like characterized by his transformation. And that's what I think is so cool about this transformation, is that it basically is what he is. And it really does kind of enforce this idea that he's just completely given into the apostle. Like, you know, he's just embraced this as power that allows him to live life even more like he wants it, which is battle, you know, seeking greatness and opponents, and just kind of drowning in the glory of the fight. And, you know, that's why we remember Zod's kind of weird bull bat form, right? The bull with the big wings, because it is him. It is the kind of, it is kind of like the embodiment of who he is. And I mean, not just to mention the kind of more symbolic elements that I was just talking about, but there's obviously, you know, the appearance. I think it's very well designed. It's simple, but it's not just terrifying. It's not just like scary and fear-inducing. It's just very imposing as well. I think those are two different things. Because like, let's say he was like some kind of snake monkey. Like, that sounds terrifying, right? Like, that would be terrifying. But I don't know if it would necessarily be like imposing, or you would be like, oof, this guy is crushing power. But Zod's apostle form, as it is in the manga, and I guess the other adaptations, is just both of those things. It is imposing and kind of like, it strikes you with a lot of fear, which is really a good way to immerse yourself in the story, because whoever faces him is probably feeling the same thing and much more strongly. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that, yeah, I mean, you know, with the mention of Zod's transformation, I think it's also worth bringing up like, you know, the common like theory, or I guess like the common sentiment, that Zod is sort of like, you know, what Guts could potentially be, or, you know, if he fully gave in to, or well if he rather if he actually ended up using the
power,
actually becoming an apostle and just sort of like giving in to that power and fully immersing himself in it. And
actually, I think I've mentioned this before, but I really would like in a future episode to talk about like the triangle of comparisons between Guts, Zod, and Skull Knight. Because, oh, yeah, so much to talk about with those three just considered in one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But anyways, Mr. Ben, I'd like to hear your number seven.
All right. So my number seven is, so Mike Guy's Eight Gates transformation from Naruto. So, I feel like, I mean, Naruto, to its credit, does have some pretty cool transformations, I will say. So I feel with Mike Guy, essentially, and this is, of course, you know, built very well, because the concept of the Eight Gates is introduced very early on in the series with Rock Lee, who is Mike Guy's disciple, who shows us his ability to awaken, I guess, five of the eight inner gates. So, and Mike, and I, of course, is able to awaken all eight, which, of course, I mean, the transformation itself is very cool. Like, I feel like, you know, Mike Guy has this sort of like this crimson red aura where like his hair is basically fire. Like, it's like, you know, in flames.
It is and
it's
fire.
Like, you just feel like this guy has so much power. Like, he's so strong. And, you know, it does come at the cost of, you know, at least normally it'd be his life, but he's able to survive, albeit, you know, injured. But
another transformation would allow him to survive.
That is true. Yes.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah.
But yeah. But yeah, I will say, yeah, it truly is a transformation that is a testament to Guy's character. This like person that like that never gives up. Like that keeps like working hard, and just by sheer hard work, he's able to reach these like amazing heights. Whereas like other characters in Naruto can only really reach those heights by like, you know, having like these outside sources of power. But
I guess like in a way it's a bit of a shame, because, you know, like Rock Lee, I think a lot of people point this out, you know, he had an amazing set of moments throughout the first part of Naruto, and then they just sort of forgot about him later on, which is really sad, because, you know, he was what I think Guy eventually became. And I'm not complaining, you know, in that sense, because Guy does become sort of what we wanted to see of Rock Lee. You know, the revealing of his past and all that is, I think, for me, almost like the last fantastic moment of Shippuden. I'm pretty confident in saying that, like of Naruto in general. Like, I think past that is just where it sort of just kind of wanders off. That I think was the last sort of like solid moment. And it was really solid. Yeah. Alrighty. So I'll go with my number seven, which is Crown Clown. Yes, this is a really weird tongue twister name. And I think it's purposeful. Thank you, Katsura Hoshino. Yes, so this is from D. Greyman. I've talked about this series before and the very interesting power system that it boasts, which is innocence, which are sort of like these gifts from God that, you know, are supposedly these holy weapons to fight against evil, but really have some weird kind of secrets to them, which we figure out in the later part of the story. But that's not really relevant to this, because this just really looks cool. And I guess for all you D. Greyman geeks out there, I'm counting Crown Clown with the Sword of Exorcism. So both of those things, I guess some people might consider them separately, but I consider them both to be part of the same thing. But Crown Clown is just sort of like this weird kind of depressing transformation. Like, I don't think everybody would think of it like that, but basically Alan is able to awaken his innocence after it's been shattered. He's able to reawaken it, and he gains this kind of form where the innocence kind of surrounds him. And, you know, he's basically, he has like, he just looks like a clown. So he has like a clown mask, and he sort of like has like almost like a jester-like cloak on. And it's just sort of weird, because like, it's not like he's acting crazy or anything like that. He's just a depressed boy, and like he's in this clown suit, and it's just like, it's such a crestfallen transformation in a way. And I think, you know, that's just a really, really, really good representation of who Alan Walker is to me, at least the protagonist of D. Greyman. He's just this sad boy that just keeps walking, you know, but he doesn't like wanna be happier. He just lets himself be sad and goes on. Like, you know, it's very kind of Guts-like in a certain way, but also it's like more like, you know, he's just a kid who got caught up in the worst of the world. And this is sort of like a really ironic gift that God has given him, quote unquote, right? And not to mention, it's also very, very cool. In fact, the sword of exorcism that I mentioned earlier is a sword that he basically makes out of his arm. He's able to take his arm off and turn it into a sword, but he doesn't have an arm then. And it gives like this really cool vibe, which is like where you would almost expect other anime just make his arm reappear or something like that. Like, you know, no, it doesn't look cool, but no, this is sort of like his style, right? Like it looks a bit weird, but at the same time, like this is Alan. He's sort of like this half and half kind of like really done dirty human who's just kind of gone through the worst possible. And I think it's also really relevant these days because he doesn't even know who he is. He's really struggling right now in the manga, which isn't moving very fast, as I mentioned, hiatus series. But I just think Crown Clown in general is like a power that Alan almost like just accepts, you know, as his own, because it is just like an embodiment of everything he is. He puts on a smile whenever he can, but really he has so many things he wants that he can't get. And it's pretty tragic in that sense. Yeah. Depresso.
All right. So for my number seven, for my number six, it's it's back to back Naruto. It's so six past Sage Mode, appropriately. So six past mode is a very cool sort of like mystical transformation. It's of course achieved in like different ways by different characters. So with Naruto, the protagonist, he achieves it by gaining six paths senjutsu from the Sage of the Six Paths, and sort of combining that with his Kyuubi, or what rather like his powers of Jinchuriki with the Nine Tails. But Madara and Obito, the antagonists, are able to achieve this form by bonding with the Ten Tails. The Ten Tails, which is the tail beasts in Naruto are like these huge like plot devices. But regardless, it is a very cool transformation. I feel like, especially with like, you know, Naruto and Madara less so Obito, but I like how like these they sort of like gain these cloaks like markings that are like,
it makes it very kind of like lordly and overpowering. Yeah, I get what you're
exactly,
saying.
Exactly. Yeah, there's like, you know, reinforced by the idea like they employ these like staffs that they use, and of course like they also have the I forgot what they're called actually, but
yeah, the truth seeking orbs. They look really cool. Yeah. They look
really
cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And it is a very cool transformation. I like how it's sort of employed by the different characters and like using all these different like techniques and whatnot. And
Really looks cool to me is how like you take Obito and Madara, which have pretty similar color palettes when they're in Jubi mode I guess Sage mode. And then you have Naruto, which is like, you know, no, I'm just glowing still.
going kind of like Super Saiyan-esque almost.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
All right. Well then, I'll move on to my number six, which is, I'm not going to spoil things, Made in Heaven. All right. First, and I guess I think, well, no, this is the second antagonist transformation that we have on my list. But this is truly a very not ex Deus Ex Machina stance. Not gonna spoil anything. But so Made in Heaven is essentially the third and final form of the stance that Enrico Pucci has been evolving over the years. And it is also kind of the final weapon that he will use, or the tool that he will use to achieve the heaven plan that he basically has inherited from Dio, who was destroyed by Jotaro, you know, one of the most powerful Joestar family members. And so essentially, you know, I think that Made in Heaven, no matter how many people may kind of criticize part six, I think it is for me what makes part six what it is, which is, going towards the end, not just the end of that part, but the end of the entire saga that kind of composed the first part of JoJo, where, you know, like we've had all of these experiences, not just with stands, but with different people, different family members, different members of the Joestar family bloodline. and just this entire group of people. And this is the final kind of enemy, you know, but it doesn't feel like it's just you worked up the ladder of a video game leveling system or something like that. It feels truly like despair. This is the power of God, basically. And I think that's enforced, especially by the aesthetic of Pucci, you know, being the father, the priest that he is, and also just the kind of reiteration of words like heaven and God and all that kind of stuff. And also, you know, it's just a, you know, typical Rocky Meadow logic. Like, you know, Pucci has like these weird kind of like instructions that he follows, like singularity point and scarab beetle and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it's just like this weird kind of ominous presence that you feel like is completely beyond your comprehension. And I think that's exactly what Araki wanted us to think, because when it happens, my God, it is one of the most twisted looking stands possible, but then also it is just so ridiculously terrifying. And I think that's what really rockets this transformation for me, at least right outside of the top 10, is that first of all, it takes place in a really, I have to say this, this is not that much of a spoiler, but it takes place in a freaking NASA station, like not in space, but like a NASA kind of museum launch station type thing, Cape Canaveral. And like, it's just so weird. It's so like, almost like, you know, trippy. I can't really find a lot of words, but it's very kind of like surreal to see like this weird half horse, half person clock face thing that isn't actually half a horse. It's more like a quarter of a horse, because it only has the four legs of a horse. And it's just, you know, the combination of all these really kind of surrealist elements really help reinforce the fact that this is a threat like no other, but also that it's like beyond anybody's understanding, even Pucci's understanding almost. And I think it really, again, a lot of people have said this, it reinforces a lot of that bittersweet idea that you kind of are left with when you finish part six, which you will all experience when you watch the anime. That was a bit of a ramble. It's hard to explain Made in Heaven. It's just so terrifying. It is like the most terrifying stand. Maybe not the most powerful, but it's definitely the most terrifying stand for me in the entirety of JoJo's.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to experiencing it for myself.
Yeah.
And yeah. All right. So number five on my list is Guts' Berserker Armor from Berserk. So this is very much, I guess, Guts sort of like the protagonist giving into his, like, I guess, pure, like primitive nature as a person, rather. Like, he has, like earlier on in the story, it's revealed that Guts has this sort of inner beast of darkness, which sort of embodies, like, Guts's, like, rage and all these, like, sort of negative emotions that he feels. And so, like, when Guts uses the Berserker Armor, which is, like, this mystical, I guess, armor that is gifted to him by Shirke, one of his allies, he just goes, like, the beast of darkness just completely takes over within him. And, you know, he just, as the title says, like, he goes berserk, like, completely. And, like,
That's like one of the coolest things, like the Berserker armor tie into Berserk.
And like the thing about this armor is that, you know, it doesn't only, you know, increase his like abilities or not, but it makes him like, I guess, almost like, I mean, yeah, in a sense, like not feel pain. Like it's not that he like can't get hurt, but he just doesn't like experience pain as like a person normally would. And like, it's sort of like,
I think what the kind of narration explains in that moment, and I'll talk about this because this appears later on my list too, is that it's sort of like completely removes inhibitors. So like these natural, not even like developed, like subconscious, like actual like neural blocks that we have that prevent us from doing things that would damage our bodies. Like even for someone like Guts, who has gone through constant injuries, once there's like a certain like strength that he needs to output to do something, he won't be able to do that, not because he doesn't have it, but because his nervous system literally won't let him. And that's what the Berserker armor just completely destroys. Oh my gosh, it's just a brutal armor, but like, yeah, it is
really
freaking cool too.
And of course, yeah, it really is, you know, a transformation that comes with this heavy price, because Guts, I mean, the Berserker armor actively hurts him. Like it's sort of like size is like his bones together and whatnot, like, and in order to like, you know, make him keep moving, but like, you know, it is, you know, it is like really like harming him. And like, you know, that's really seen in like the latest chapter when like he Guts has almost become sort of reliant on the Berserker armor.
Yeah, that was like was another heartbreaking moment of that chapter.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, definitely. He was almost like weak now. He let go of the Dragon Slayer because it was almost like he just, I mean, again, the Dragon Slayer is quite a thing to wield, but you know,
yeah,
compared to the Guts of before, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
All right. So I'll get to my number five, which is Full Hollowfication Ichigo. Everybody says that it's Vasto Lordy Ichigo, but thanks to my dear friend Ben, I have been converted to the way of the right. You know, it is Full Hollowfication, which I think, you know, without trying to be too pretentious, is sort of really a link in to what makes this transformation special, which is that Ichigo is beyond anything in terms of what kind of a mix he is. He is everything that you could possibly imagine in the Bleach universe. Fullbringer, like, you know, just name everything. Just name everything. That the Ichigo is that.
yeah. And
I guess, like, that's what makes him so special is that, like, you know, and I'll get to the plot-based significance of this, because even though this is visually stunning, I mean, it is Kubo, by the way, he wouldn't do anything unless it looked completely baffling visually. The plot-based significance of this transformation is what makes it, like, so good, in my opinion. But in any case, Ichigo is an anomaly in this world. He isn't really guided by any concrete goals, but he just continues. And by kind of following the kind of more short-term objectives, like protecting his friends or achieving something that doesn't really have a massive long-term impact, and just staying within the moment, which is very like Ichigo as his personality is built up to be, you know, you sort of kind of get to this point where, you know, you realize that he's changing things as he goes along. And this Full Hollowfication form is a representation of the fact that he isn't just some kind of wandering kind of like, you know, ranger. He's like a very great force to be reckoned with, especially because you just don't know who he is. You don't know what powers he has in store for himself. And that has always been the danger that Ichigo poses to his enemies, which is his massive potential. That's like even elaborated on in the final arc as well. Like, he was eliminated before he could even use the coolest thing we had freaking seen, because it scared the crap out of the person that knew he would get stronger and be able to do damage with it. And so essentially, Full Hollowfication Ichigo is also, I mean, you can't go on without not mentioning this, the form that Ichigo takes on in his most desperate moment. It is when he has absolutely no power, he's essentially dead. And in order to conquer despair itself, which is embodied in Ulquiorra, who is, I mean, in my opinion, you can't tell me any way else, the most powerful espada there is. I will not back down. He is number four. Shut up. There's no one more powerful than Ulquiorra. You cannot tell me that freaking Stark. No. That's ridiculous. But essentially, you know, Ichigo is willing to do things that he may not have, you know, if he had a long time to think about it, have considered very ethically correct. But at the end of the day, he is Ichigo, this really iconic protagonist, because of his personality. He's gentle, and in the moment, he realizes that, you know, he needs to protect what he cares about. And that, for me, is a goal, you know, way, you know, not worth criticizing as, oh, it's not concrete, he doesn't want to become Hokage or Magic King or whatever. You know, I think the way that he's able to kind of pull out this incredible power that really makes him almost morally, you know, completely lost, you know, because he's lost to this hollow beast where he has all the power he could possibly need to defeat Ulquiorra, but he would go continue raging on if it weren't for, like, you know, certain factors getting in the way. You know, you see sort of how Ichigo is lost, but this is just who he is. He's just going to keep going and just let kind of fate take him and then take initiative when he realizes that his goal is being threatened. And, you know, this is just a learning curve for him, I think, where he realizes that that goal can often lead him to do the opposite of what he wants. And I think it is just a very pivotal point, you know, in showing us that Ichigo isn't just the rising hero. He is a very mysterious force to be reckoned with, you know, not just in that arc, but throughout the entire story, which is especially highlighted on with his Quincy heritage, spoilers there, in the later arc.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, full homification is an amazing transformation, and it does show up later on my list, but yeah, and I feel like there is a very, it does have a pretty cool similarity, in my opinion, to the Berserker armor, because they're both these forms in which, the users of them aren't really fully conscious. They're just sort of, in this state where, they just, they're on this rampage where, they're not.
They're berserk.
They're berserk, yes. They're just berserk.
All right, then let's see how your number four, right? Yeah.
All right. So number four is my number four is Kenpachi's Bankai, also from Bleach. So Kenpachi is the captain of the 11th division of the
the protagonist of the Thousand Year Blood War.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, but yeah, so he's captain of the 11th division of the Shinigami, and like Quentin said, he is pretty pivotal in the Thousand Year Blood War arc, which is the final arc of the Bleach manga that hasn't been adapted yet into anime, but hopefully will be in 2022. But anyway, yeah, so Kenpachi is a very interesting character, because he's a captain, but but at least at the beginning of the series, he hasn't yet achieved Bankai or even Shikai, which are the two releases of the Zanpakutos, which are the swords of the Shinigami. And it's kind of weird, because you're like, okay, this guy is super powerful, but he's not even in his Shikai. So what heights can this guy possibly reach? And then, we kind of learned that in the Thousand Year Blood War arc, that even then, Kenpachi had already been suppressing his power. So even with just his base Zanpakuto, he still had so much of his power suppressed. But then when he finally is able to activate his Shikai, it is pretty amazing. His Shikai alone is pretty amazing.
His Shikai alone is a big meat cleaver, yes.
Yeah, it has powers cut through meteors, which is the most amazing feats I've seen a Bleach character do. But but Kenpachi's Bankai is, oh my god, yeah. So it's interesting, because it physically transforms him. He becomes this red devil. Demon.
He's just a devil. Yeah, he's just a demon.
He's the devil, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's completely just he's going berserk. He's just
we have a kind of a bias towards these kinds of transformations, right?
Yeah, definitely. Well, and that manga, that one, I feel like that one panel where
he's just on the ground with all the blood, and he's oh my gosh. And also the panel of his face where he has those weird markings,
Yeah, but it's just, oh my god, when that gets animated, I feel like break the anime.
Well, because I think the biggest thing about that transformation, for me at least, is that we knew Kenpachi was capable of a Bankai, because every Bleach character is capable of that. We knew Kubo was not going to let us down and just not show his Bankai, right? And just the satisfaction of seeing him finally pull it out is just so awesome.
It really is.
It's not one bit less awesome than we would have anticipated. It is exactly what we wanted. And I feel like it's just it looks cool too. I mean, again, Kubo doesn't really do things that don't look good. We don't do that here, but All right, so I'll get to my number four, which is Kagune/Kakuya transformations for Ken Kaneki, the Tokyo Ghoul protagonist and Tokyo Ghoul re-protagonist. So the reason I said plural transformations is because I feel like the evolution of Kaneki's Kakuja forms are really what kind of, they kind of culminate together in this kind of gradation of Kaneki's kind of acceptance of his identity as a ghoul, as a human, et cetera, et cetera. I really, really love Tokyo Ghoul and Re. I'm kind of considering them as the same. They just represent two halves of a story. And I think, every time that the kagune, or the kind of claws, as they're called most of the time in quotes, you know, that the ghouls whip out, they change, you realize that there's been an essential change in their character. It is almost always like that, especially with Kaneki, the protagonist, who isn't originally a ghoul, but is able to rise to such heights in his power that every time he releases another kagune or kakuja, which is a kind of a heightened form of kagune, you know, either it looks demonic or angelic. And it's really interesting because, you know, at the end of the first series, I guess it's not really, you know, that much of a spoiler, you know, he has this demonic centipede form, whereas at the end of the second series, he has almost like this angelic, quote unquote, dragon form. And it just, it's really kind of, you know, what I think makes me love Kaneki, which is like this weird inner struggle. Like, you know, a lot of people say, oh, Kaneki's biggest rival is himself, which I guess, yeah, that makes sense. Even though it's cringy, it is completely true. You know, like his battle with himself, and the fact that he's using this kind of demonic self, this ghoul self, which is also where the kakuja comes from, to fight his enemies and achieve his goals. You know, he uses that to kind of plow through his learning procedure and the way that he's able to sort of like accept himself. Because at the end of the day, I will stand by the fact, or the theory, let's just say, that Tokyo Ghoul is a story purely about self-acceptance, and that being the development of the character. And I especially like that gradation from the demonic kind of centipede form to the dragon form, where, you know, it's almost like Kaneki, after going so many hardships and losing his humanity beyond a doubt, I mean, you know, by the end of the series, he's completely flushed out every kind of human cell that he has, to the point where physicians of both ghouls and humans cannot identify his internal organs. You know, you just know that he's sort of like, that's the biggest challenge for him. Now that he's not human or ghoul or anything that anybody can identify, you know, he still accepts himself. And I think that's, you know, not even mentioning all the cool power-ups that it gives him, but it just looks really fantastic, especially with Ishida's art. I mean, man. Yeah, whenever I talk about Tokyo Ghoul, I'm just going to sound really depressed. Not because it's a sad series, just because it is a very melancholy series, I will say. Yeah.
Hmm? Yeah, definitely, yeah. All right. So, okay, so on to my number four. It's, you know, it all right, so... I mean, no, my number three now.
Yes, yes, we're in the top three.
So, all right. So my number three is, it's back-to-back Bleach. It's Ichigo's full holification. So, yeah, I mean, Quinton already talked about this one, but like, I mean, oh my God, like visually, I mean, this animation, this transformation is truly a sight to behold. It's like, you know, like Ichigo has this, like long hair for some reason, which I guess I don't know if this is somewhat of a
trend. A long hair is part of every... the hair is the first thing they go for.
Oh my God, yeah, like he just, I mean, you know, it's like, you know, he's, I mean, besides the body shape, it's like one of those transformations where like the character has like truly like transformed his essence. Like there's like little like recognizable features of like Ichigo like still in there, but like you know, I mean, but yeah, I mean, you know,
the hair is almost like the only thing alongside, like, I guess his general physique that really gives it away that it's Ichigo. Yeah. Cause like the mask is everywhere and the horns too. It's like,
Yeah. I mean, I really feel like, cause I mean, aren't the, I mean, I feel like that, like the hollows, I mean, well, yeah, I mean, the hollows like are very clearly like, Kubo uses a very clear, I guess, like Spanish or like Hispanic inspiration, which of course like coincides with like how he like uses like different cultural inspirations for like the different species, like, you know, I guess like Japanese culture obviously for the Shinigami, and German culture for the Quincy's. But yeah, but I mean, Ichigo, I feel like really embodies this like sort of like, you know, like this
everything.
Yeah, oh my God, it's just, it's an amazing form, like, definitely.
Well, yeah, and especially the point at which it comes into the series, and honestly, I'm going to talk about this one later in the video, but it really does give me some Gon's adult form vibes, in the sense that it is just complete despair leading to, like, this last-ditch effort, which is beyond any of the viewer's expectations. It is amazing, truly, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, well, I'll get to my number three, which is another one you've already mentioned, which is the Berserker armor. So, I mean, I've talked about this one before. I'm not going to go over the things that Ben said because he's basically reflected a lot of what I wanted to say. And, you know, I, of course, because we've talked about Berserk a lot by now. So I'm sure we have some pretty common understandings about the Berserker armor and other things Berserk. But I mean, again, visually, oof, the Berserker armor. Like, I will have to say, like, the first thing that sort of kind of like didn't really, you know, please me about the Berserker armor visually was actually the dog helmet. So the kind of hound helmet. But I have to say, in certain vantage points, it looks absolutely fantastic, particularly in that one panel. Oh my gosh, where you like see kind of like the open mouth Berserker armor, like just, you can hear that scream, that howl.
Yeah, definitely.
And the eyes as well, like the eyes, you know, like you can see, it's like almost like they've been smeared back or something like that. You know, you can see that this is the Berserker in guts completely released. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's incredible to see as well, I think, you know, how Shirka is able to kind of assist him in that kind of situation, right? Like, you know, Shirka is able to use her understanding of the astral world to kind of represent a lifeline for Guts to pull him out of this kind of demonic state. And I mean, keep in mind, Guts is incredibly strong-willed. Of course, he's obviously a very angry character, but just to see like Mura, you know, using his masterful understanding of how to write stories, you know, decide, hey, like, we're not going to make this guy go through a transformation where like he's not angry anymore. This guy is angry and there's no reason he shouldn't be angry. Why don't we make that his biggest weapon? And that's exactly what the Berserker armor does. It allows Guts to fight on par with incredibly powerful apostles without turning into a human. And it is really that, the human word right there, that I think is so important about this. The Berserker armor draws every ounce of strength out of a human, and not just any human, the strongest human that we know of in the series, and allows him to go on par with people who have accepted power that is not their own. This is all of his power. Like, I think that's a really important thing to mention. The Berserker armor isn't something that uses magic to enhance Guts. It gives him the ability to use every last ounce of his strength, which I think is just the most beautiful power possible. Like, you know, I'm gonna just gonna like push back your limitations for you. You can just go completely crazy.
Pretty much. Yeah, I draw that element of drawing out like Guts's like hidden potential is very cool, definitely. Yeah, yeah. And I feel like I really like seeing like it's different stages as well. Like, I mean, I feel like I mean, of course, like the form, like where, like, you know, it's like basically like the beast of darkness personified. I feel like that is definitely the most iconic form. I feel like it is the most visually appealing. But I also really like the like Guts's more controlled like version of the Berserk armor, where like he basically looks like Batman.
And ears up, right?
The point here.
That's the one, yeah. Where he was. I barely noticed that shift. That's the one that he used against the Sea God, right? Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Right? I'm not mistaken there.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. But, yeah,
and
but
I also just like how like the bottom jaw is just sticking out all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. When I saw that transformation, like Guts is, you know, controlled version of the Berserker armor, I was actually, I mean, I was pretty surprised. I mean, you know, of course, I mean, it looks like Batman, like even more so than like, you know, Femto does. But I feel like there's this very like interesting panel, which is actually kind of shocked me. Like, it's where Guts like is like first gains control of the Berserker armor, but like he's like he takes this pose where like it's actually I feel like there's this very clear parallel to Femto's pose when he first like, you know, when he first like awakens. And I'm not sure if you know what I'm talking about.
Like where his shoulders are down and his head is down and stuff.
Yeah, kind of. I feel like Guts takes a very similar pose in that, like, okay, like in that panel, which kind of shocked me. I felt like, you know, what? Like, is Mura trying to create some kind of like parallel here?
Was it anyway that similar? Wow. Okay, cool.
Yeah, I mean, I can like send it to you, but like, I feel like, well, it was.
Yeah, I would like that because like Femto also takes that pose up when like in that really freaking like one of the best panels of Berserk. Oh, where like Skull Knight pulls out the Sword of Actuation, like inside Ganishka, which sounds really weird, but I guess that's actually what happened. And like he's behind Femto, and Femto's just like
yeah
he's just like yeah. All right, well, I'll get to my number two, right? No, I just did my number three. What am I saying? No, now it's your number two. Yes.
Yeah. All right. So my number two is Yusuke's demon form from Yu Yu Hakusho. So,
yes. I haven't watched Yu Yu Hakusho, but it looks fantastic. I'm glad you put it on your list.
It is an amazing form. So, I feel like I feel like the way in which it's brought about is actually very similar to like, Ichigo with his full holification, but essentially Yusuke is put in this position. He's facing this extremely powerful opponent, Sensui, and he's being pushed to like essentially his absolute limit, right? I mean, Yusuke is like, you know, otherwise like he can't really like fully match this person. So like, you know, so like at this crucial moment, his inner demon blood sort of takes over, like, and allows him to transform into like this like demonic form with like this longer
sword. Hair.
And of course longer, that's like a common theme, and like
dark, people, like it's emo Super Saiyan 3, that's
pretty much, yeah, like emo Super Saiyan 3. And he gains these really cool like body markings, which like add this like sort of like mystic element to it. And so Yusuke is like, I mean, he's not going completely berserk, like he's just like going like just like all in, just beating the crap out of like his opponent. And like he's just like, he's become this very like cocky, like uncaring version of himself. And when he finally like snaps out of this, like, you know, out of this state, he just like, he's become so frustrated because, you know, he has beaten his opponent Sensui, but like
he's basically, I need to read Yu Yu Hakusho.
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard a lot of other good things, like also the main protagonist of the tournament arc, or the main antagonist of the tournament arc, has a very nice transformation, apparently.
Toguro has a very cool form. It's 100%, or rather is 120% full power form.
He looks like a tree. Yeah. He looks like a plant sometimes, like with the weird kind pretty of like much, yeah. Yeah, okay. My number two, we've already talked about this one, so I'm not going to go over it too long, but my number two is Adult Gon. So I remember, actually, this is a really weird way to link it in, but I think it somehow feels right. Just looking up the theme that was playing on Adult Gon's theme on like a music streaming platform and listening to it and feeling chills, like chills that could rival the ones that I felt when I actually saw the scene. Just the thought of that scene gives me chills. And the fact that like, it's just so terrifying to see this happy-go-lucky kid just go completely bonkers. And I know, you know, there are a lot of people who have made a lot of detailed analyses on YouTube or, you know, on other platforms, like showing how there were a lot of hints in throughout the earlier parts of Hunter x Hunter showing that Gon was not sane, that he was going to snap under this much pressure. Not that anybody could really foresee it, but in retrospect, I think it is an amazing, you know, way of showing how Togashi is, you know, even if he didn't foresee that that was Gon's kind of full powered mode and that's how it would come about through that contract and that sacrifice of like his ability to use Nen or even his life. You know, I just feel like it's so terrifying because no one is happy. I feel like no one is completely happy. Like, yeah, sure, we get to see Pito get beaten, but, you know, we see Gon, like, crying when he's victorious, but I feel like he knows he's lost everything. He knows that he's completely overcome, and I think what makes this even worse is the amount of time, you know, we switch back from whatever else is happening in the palace invasion arc to the room where Gon is just staring down Pito with this incredible murderous intent. And, you know, the slow kind of culmination of this really ominous, like almost rotten black Nen that surrounds Gon when he's powering up and raging, like just waiting to kill her. Like, you know, and his willingness to threaten people that he would never have threatened before. I just think it is such a brutal transformation. And also just like it's one of those ones where you can just watch the downfall and just, you know, just kind of brace yourself. And when the impact hits, it hits like really, really freaking hard. Yeah. What a transformation. Yeah, I think it's just one of those ones that like, no matter what, it's going to leave a mark on you. And I think that's what makes it so fantastic. Yep.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, it is, you know, a transformation that almost sort of makes us, I mean, yeah, like you said, sort of fear gone, especially like, you know, when he's mid transformation and you see him as like this sort of like shadow. It's just like, he's like this complete, he's lost all sort of like, also sort of shape. And he's just like this, he's like this shadowy figure. It's like,
yeah,
you know,
that is one of the coolest freaking sequences.
Pure murderous intent. Yeah.
Like I've seen it in the manga. I think it actually looks pretty much like let downy in the manga, which is weird because it came first before the anime, but in the anime, my gosh, it is amazing to see that weird kind of like shadow, like white and black, like mass. It's just like, oof,
Yeah. Well, all right.
Yeah. Go ahead and get number one. Let's see it.
All right. Yeah. So for my number one, it's Super Saiyan 4 from Dragon Ball GT. Yes. me with the
an uncanon transformation as your number one. How dare you?
Wait, what?
Isn't it uncanon still, or did like Togashi canonize it? I was just making a joke. You know, it doesn't really matter.
It's not canon, but this is pretty ironic because like Super Saiyan 4 showed up in Dragon Ball GT, which honestly, it's not as bad as like as some have said it is, but you know, regardless, it it definitely is in the peak of Dragon Ball, and it is a non-canon series, like meaning that Super Saiyan 4 is ultimately a non-canon form, but really, honestly, Super Saiyan 4, I mean, you know, it's the monkey form, but yeah, I mean, it's like... The
monk
really,
form. Just take a minute to clear your throat.
Yeah.
Because like, I wanted to say something anyway, which is that like, you know, I feel like Super Saiyan 4 really is sort of like a weird kind of like kind of payoff of our expectations, because there have been so many parallels to Goku's kind of inspiration of the like being the Monkey King of the Journey to the West, one of the four ancient Chinese classics, and just seeing the way that like, you know, he's just monk now. He is Sun Wukong.
Exactly. He has become the Monkey King. But I feel to me like this form is like really the epitome of what a Saiyan can be. Like, because Saiyans are like, you know, Goku, of course, like has shown to be able to transform into a giant ape in the original Dragon Ball. And then of course it's revealed that this ability is like inherent within all Saiyans when they see the full moon. So you already like see how Saiyans are like, they have these sort of ties to like, you know, apes. And when with Super Saiyan 4, I feel like, honestly, to me, it's like a true, I mean, it's almost like the true version of Super Saiyan. It's like really the epitome of what a Saiyan can be, like a Saiyan at their core essence, essentially. And I feel like, yeah. The design is like so cool. And you'll notice that like it has like these yellow eyes. Well, he's Goku in his form. He has yellow eyes with red sort of like highlights around them, which I feel like is very similar to the to Sage Mode with Naruto. And I feel like I'm not sure if like this is like you know, it did reference like if it did take inspiration, but I feel like honestly I wouldn't be surprised if it did, because I feel like in that essence they're kind of like they're similar. Yeah,
peanut butter jelly color.
Indeed. Yeah.
Marmalade, yeah. Fur. Yes. No, it looks cool. I know. All right. So my number one is Tusk Act 4. Like this is the epitome of, I think, like, you know, a power-based, ability-based transformation that is intriguing and captivating, that makes you marvel at the power that the character has gained. The character in this case being the protagonist of Steel Ball Run, the seventh part of JoJo's, Johnny Joestar. But then, you know, also, like, I think even more importantly than that, even though that is also incredible that its powers are so interesting and different from the three forms of Tusk we saw previously, like, this is also a culmination of everything that Steel Ball Run has been building up to, And, you know, which is, I guess, also synonymous to what I just said, the relationship between Gyro and Johnny, probably the best deuterogamous duo that I have ever met or experienced, at least one of them, no doubt. And I think just like, this is going to be so hard not to spoil, but in any case, you know, like things happen in this final arc of JoJo's that really force Johnny into a position where he cannot make excuses for himself anymore. And again, this has been something that has been building up for a long time. Johnny becomes more and more ruthless as the series goes on, more and more willing to do what he needs to do to win the race, or rather to achieve his goals in its essence, no matter what it means, if it means killing. And it is just like, I think Araki, this is one of the best things he's done artistically. Like Johnny's eyes, like kind of symbolically, but not really. It's like one of those moments where like, is this metaphorical or is it not? Like his eyes start to burn. And that is sort of like the symbolism of his determination. And like, you know, to see Johnny just rise from kind of like the ashes of this kind of really kind of like half-hearted kid that he was, where after he was taken what he had earned through being a prodigy, so basically not really working, but just being a natural, you know, after he's been taken the ability to be a jockey, and he's no longer has his legs, he meets Gyro, who is able to give him everything back and more. You know, he's able to teach him the beauty of not just himself, but the world through spin. And I think that is what makes me admire Araki's kind of buildup of spin so much, because it is not just a power, it is also like the integral aspect of the Steel Ball Run arc, or the Steel Ball Run part, right? Like it is more than that. It is rooted within the story, the relationships between the characters, and eventually, you know, the ability that Tusk Act 4 gains after, you know, Johnny is basically pushed to the absolute limit, where he gains the ability of infinite spin. Infinite spin and Tusk Act 4 are synonymous. That's what I think is also so cool about the stands of Steel Ball Run. Those who use spin, basically, I mean, I guess that's only Johnny and Gyro in this situation, basically are capable of fighting with stands, but the stands are really only a manifestation of their spin. Those are two and the same for those characters who use spin. And I think that is further reinforced by the fact that the infinite spin, which is the final ability Johnny gains through the last lesson Gyro gives him, is basically, you know, Tusk Act 4. And, you know, he's able to use that ability to surpass something that looked completely insurpassable, while also suffering from a lot of emotional turbulence in the process, which I think makes this whole experience so much more interesting, because, you know, through this fight and through Johnny turning the tables on Valentine, I guess it's not really a surprise there, but a bit of spoilers, you know, you see both of these characters push their limits, and you see how both of them completely abandon morality for their objectives, which really makes you as a reader almost question, like, well, doesn't that make sense to a certain extent? You know, if like, you can't make excuses to try to make it seem like what you did was just to achieve what you wanted to, right? I think that's what Johnny, in my opinion, really learns in that moment, which allows him to gain so much power. It's also just, I think, mainly what makes this such, like, the biggest transformation for me is the sentimental value it has between the two characters. And sort of like, you know, Johnny just being let go down the runway by Gyro, because he now is able to fly by himself, you know, which is really, really, really beautiful. Yeah.
All right. Yes. So, all right. So those were our top 10 transformations. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. It was very fun. It probably was a bit like pushing the boundaries of transformation for some picks, but I had a lot of fun. And I hope you guys did too. We'll see you guys next week. Have a very nice week. Make it to the next episode, please, strugglers. Keep struggling in order to do so.
Yes.
I don't know what I'm saying anymore. Okay. Well then.